We're on a new chapter, that is chapter 31, and just to bring you back up to date, Jacob has just pulled a swift move where he took Laban's flocks, those that were speckled and spotted, and by some kind of genetic wizardry, he said to Laban, "I'll take only the ones that are, you know, that are in some way less valuable than the ones that are pure and clean." That's those that are spotted or speckled, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, which is a poem by Hopkins. Whatever is counter-original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how. It's a beautiful poem called God's Grandeur. Anyway, so that's what he says to Laban, and Laban says, fine, and then he takes the flock out, and by showing them sticks, putting them in front of their eyes, and putting spotted animals in front of their eyes, he produces a large flock of spotted and speckled animals and becomes rich. And in fact, not only does he become rich, but the last line that we read in verse 43 of chapter 30 says, "V'yifrotz ha'ish," which means, so the man grew exceedingly prosperous. But it reminds us of 28:21, where God says to him, is it 28:21? I thought it was. Let's see. I have the wrong verse. He says to him, "Ufaratzta," that you will spread out, right? North and east and south and west, where God makes the promise that Jacob will yifrotz, and now he's yifrotzing. That is, he's beginning to be prosperous and will continue to be so, although he'll have other challenges along the way. The one thing one of the things that we're dealing with here that we haven't dealt with before is the world of work. Because Jacob is the first one whose work world we've really gotten a glimpse into. And the truth is that that's a big part of the world of any human being, and we've been dealing mostly with domestic life and not so much with public life. But now Jacob is making a living, and he's making a good living, and he's having a struggle about the business with his father-in-law. I mean, this is really, you know, this is not a new phenomenon, right? Laban is the one who has the money, and he has the daughters, and when Jacob takes money and daughters away from him, realize that Laban is losing a lot. A lot. You can understand why Laban is struggling against this, and you'll see his struggle in a minute. But you can imagine that it doesn't only involve Laban. Let's say, okay, I have a family. You marry into my family, and then you leave with some of my wealth and two of my daughters. Who's going to protest other than me? My sons, exactly so. You're taking their wealth too, remember. They're the ones, you're right, my wife, but especially my sons are the ones we're going to inherit. And if my wife protests, she's probably protesting on behalf of her sons too. However, we haven't heard that Laban has sons yet, right? But now we turn to chapter 21. 31. "Now he heard the things that Laban's sons were saying. Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from that which was our father's, he's built up all his wealth." Right? So exactly what you would expect is what happens, which is Laban's sons now are angry at Jacob's. First of all, Jacob is marrying their sisters, which is fraught in other ways, right? And just as a father doesn't want to see a father doesn't want to see a daughter married, there are always issues there. It's also true with a brother and a sister, right? And the issue doesn't only have to be sexual, it can be intimate, right? Your sister was your sister your whole life. Now, all of a sudden, she becomes this guy's wife, which is a hard thing because you immediately become secondary. So they don't like the whole idea, and they say, you know, obviously, and you never want to claim your own interest. It's always because of someone else. So they don't say he's taking our money, which in fact he is in some sense. Rather, he's taking our father's money. So they're noble in their selfishness. And it also follows the pattern that we know from Lavan. Lavan is not a generous guy. He's deceptive, he's grasping, and lo and behold, so are his sons, right? From whom we have never heard a word of welcome, and we've never seen them with Jacob. All the first time we hear them speak, it's Jacob's taking all our money. Not that he's worked for us for 15 years, right? And by the way, if you remember, it's Jacob who's increased Lavan's wealth, which means who hasn't increased Lavan's wealth? His sons, exactly. You can just see the lazy, good-for-nothing sons eating their potato chips in front of the TV. And all of a sudden, Jacob is leaving, and they understand that their meal ticket is going because Jacob's the one who's been making all the money. So Jacob also saw that Lavan's manner toward him was not as it has been in the past. Now, this is a really, I must say, this is an idiomatic translation, but not a good one. It says, Vayar Yaakov et Pnei Lavan. What's a panim? His face, okay? Jacob saw the face of Lavan, and behold, it was not as it had been before, okay? Now, the idea that his face changed is much more powerful than the idea that his manner changed. And the commentators say a lot about what that means, that Lavan's face changed towards him. Pinchas Peli, who was a wonderful commentator on the Torah, who was from Bar Ilan and used to come and speak at synagogues from time to time. He used to write before Riskin wrote the Torah column in the Jerusalem Post. Pinchas Peli did for many years. And Peli wrote a column about the fact that what this really means is for the first time Jacob saw Lavan's true face. Because for all these years, Lavan was being nice to him because he wanted him to build up his wealth. But now all of a sudden, in that instant when Lavan is angry that Jacob is leaving, Jacob sees his true face. Because remember, when Lavan first meets him, already he's dreaming of wealth. If I can take you back for a second, as long as we're talking faces, this is what happened. I'm going to read you the story of Cain and Abel for a second. Okay, you're welcome to go back with me to chapter 4, but you don't have to if you don't want to. I'm going to chapter 4, verse 6. Remember, God accepts Abel's sacrifice and rejects Cain's sacrifice. Okay? And Cain gets very upset. And God says, why are you distressed, and why is your face fallen? V'lama naflu panecha. Why has your face fallen? Okay? Then later, it says, and Cain said to his brother Abel, Vayomer Kayan el Hevel Achiv, Vayiyu beyotam basadeh, and when they were in the field. And it never says what Cain said to Abel, right? All the Midrashim talk about it, but it never says. It just says, when Cain said to Abel, and they were in the field. That's it, okay? So it's missing some phrase there. And then it says, and when they were in the field, Cain set upon his brother Abel and killed him. So all the commentators wonder, what did they say to each other that led to the murder? And the reason I bring this up is that a great modern Jewish philosopher, whom not very many people in America know of, because he was French, and he's very well known in France, but not very well known here, named Levinas, right? Emmanuel Levinas, who I think himself went through the Holocaust. His entire family, I know, did. And just died a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, Levinas's whole philosophy is built on the idea of the other and the other's face, and that all of morality derives from being able to look at the other and see the other. Okay, that's Levinas's central concept. And what he says is the reason that Cain killed Abel was because he didn't look into his face. And that's why the elliptical conversation is there. He went to talk to him, but he never looked into his face, which was why he was able to kill him, because, says Levinas, you can't honestly look and see the other and still do violence to the other. That it's only when you don't see the other, when you deliberately unsee, when you force yourself not to see the other, and he got this, I mean, this was based in part on his experience with the Holocaust, It's when you don't see the other that you can do violence to the other. So this is the first time that Laban and Jacob show their real face to each other, but Laban's real face is one that doesn't see, right? Jacob does, but Laban clearly doesn't. What Laban sees in Jacob is a means of advancing his own interests, which is what he does. And notice what God says to Jacob right afterwards, right? As soon as Laban's manner changes, God says, "Return to the land of your fathers where you were born, and I will be with you." Does this sound familiar? It's what God says to Jacob right at his dream with the ladders, which is, I will be with you. And now he's repeating to him, return, don't worry, I will be with you. Jacob had Rachel and Leah called to the field where his flock was. Now, why does he call to the field and he doesn't go to the house? Those are all good answers. He's leaving, he doesn't want to go back, but the commentators say he doesn't want Laban to overhear him. No. Right. That's why he calls him out to the field, because the field is the safe place. Like in these spy movies, the one place you know isn't bugged, right, is the field, right? The house is bugged, but in the field you can go out and you can walk and you can speak. So Jacob had Rachel and Leah called to the field. Now the fact that he had them called means he didn't even go back and call them. He sent someone else to go and bring them to the field. And he says, again, I see that Pnei Avichen, the face of your father, is not as it was towards me yesterday and the day before, in other words, in the past. And the God of my father has been with me. In other words, even though your father is not with me, my God is with me. And now here there is a point in every healthy marriage, okay? And I emphasize the word healthy marriage, when the parent gets substituted and the spouse takes the parent's place, okay? It doesn't happen on the day of the wedding, since after all, the wedding is all about the parents, right? But at some point, I tell couples this when they come, they say, my parents are so, and I say, look, this is, you know, unless you get married much older or it's a second marriage, if the parents are still alive, the parents have a tremendous investment in the wedding. We all know that, right? So but at a certain point in the marriage, and there are lots of circumstances under which this happens, the parents fade, the generational tide turns, and you face towards children as opposed to towards parents, and it looks like this is the moment where this is happening for Jacob. He's been in Laban's house, but now he says, your father isn't with me, but my God is with me. So you guys have to make a choice. Are you going to trust me and my God, or are you going to stay with your father? And obviously, they're going to go with Jacob, but I think this is the Bible's echo of what every married couple knows happens or doesn't happen in their wedding. As you know, I've served your father with all my might, but your father has cheated me, changing my wages time and again. God, however, would not let him do me harm. If he said, thus the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flocks would drop speckled young. And if he said, the streaked shall be your wages, then all the flocks would drop streaked young. God has taken away your father's livestock and given it to me. Now, this is not what we read happened. Right? What did we read happened? What we read happened was that Jacob cleverly, through genetic manipulation, got the flock of his father Laban. But he doesn't attribute it to his own smarts. He attributes it to God. Which, there are a lot of ways of reading this. One way of reading it is that Jacob believes that God did it. Another way of reading it is that he wants them to know that he's really going to be taken care of, and they will be taken care of, and they don't have to depend only on him, that he has, you know, family money, that God is with him, right? That he's backed up behind this. And also, it's a way of suggesting that he didn't cheat their father, right? It's not that I did this to your father, it's that God helped me and enabled me to have these riches, and therefore coming with me is also not, you don't need to feel guilty about coming with me, because you're not doing anything bad to your father. In fact, he owed me this money, and we'll see, by the way, that that's what Rachel and Leah say, that he didn't even give them, and I'm going to stop a little bit early to just give you one or two words about Pesach, since we're not going to meet again before the Seder. And then we'll take questions and comments about this. But Rachel and Leah say later that he's used up their bride price. Remember that he owes Jacob, each woman comes with a certain bride price from the father-in-law. The fact that Jacob didn't get that even shows that he doesn't value his daughters as well as he doesn't, because that's really theirs, right? It's theirs to use when they go to, and in fact, in Jewish law, they get it back if they divorce, right? So it's theirs to use, and if Lavan used it up, it not only shows a lack of respect for Jacob, it shows that he cheated them, okay? Let me just read the one more section about Jacob and his dream. Once at the mating time of the flocks, I had a dream in which I saw that the he-goats mated with the flock were streaked, speckled, and mottled. And in the dream, an angel of God said to me, Jacob, here, I answered. And he said, note well that all the he-goats which are mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, and mottled, for I've noted all that Laban has been doing with you, but I am the God of Beit El, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise and leave this land and return to your native land. Okay? Now, if you want to be a cynic, you can say that it's very convenient that we haven't heard about this dream till now, which ties everything together very nicely for Jacob, right? But dreams were very powerful motivators in the ancient world as they are in the modern world. And Jacob has, in fact, carried all this out, and there's no reason for him to tell anyone his dream until now. Presumably, lots of people had lots of dreams in the time of the Bible that don't get recorded. So it's not implausible that Jacob had this dream and that God told him to return. Even if you interpret it psychologically, sometimes your dreams come at the right time of life because it's what you want anyway, or it's what you feel is right anyway. So Jacob has clearly come to the point where he's done with Laban, right? We get that sense. And now comes the dream where God tells him it's time to leave. So however you look at it, whether you look at it as a divine dream or you look at it as a psychologically motivated dream, it does make sense that now would be the time when Jacob would know he's all done, right? He's married, he has kids, he has wealth, he doesn't need Laban anymore. And that also could be the motivation for why Laban no longer looks benevolently on him, because it's much easier to be nice to someone who's still under your thumb and needs you. But once Jacob has his money and has his children, Laban recognizes that Jacob is in some ways a rival to him. And so his face, as I said before, turns from what it was. Now, let's stop there for a minute and just talk for a second about the Passover Seder to say one or two things. How many of you have eighth graders? Okay, I only say this because I told the eighth graders this, and I told them they could say this at their Passover Seder, and their parents wouldn't know. So if they say this at the Passover Seder, just, you know, right, be surprised. What I did with them this year was the plagues, right? And I introduced, and the reason that I want to tell you this is because this is based on an article by Tzioni Zevit. And several of you were here 2 weeks ago when Professor Zevit taught. And this is a wonderful observation where he goes through it in detail. You may be able to call the article up, I don't know, on the internet, but I don't remember, it was published many years ago. Anyway, but it's a very interesting way of thinking about the plagues, because the plagues are one of those things that we don't usually spend much time on, because, you know, they're all death and destruction, and usually all we get out of the plagues is that, isn't it wonderful the Jews don't take joy in the destruction of their enemies, and we drop wine, you know, one drop of wine for each plague with a spoon, a toothpick, or your finger, depending on where you were born. But what are the plagues all about, really? I mean, first of all, they're not so miraculous, if you think about it, because if God can create the world, the fact that he can turn the Nile to blood is really a very small thing, right? He created the cosmos. He made stars and moons and earth. So big deal, he can turn water different colors. And if it were just to demonstrate that God's amazing, you would think that really it would be much more amazing if he would just scoop up the Israelites and deposit them in the desert. There are a lot of ways. This is a very sort of pedestrian way for a god to, and obviously part of this is to convince the Egyptians as well as the Israelites that God is, which is why so many of the plagues are directed specifically against Israelite gods. The Nile is a god, right? Egyptian gods. The Nile is a god. Beasts are worshipped, right? And also, they're directed in a way to particularly be humiliating, right? Why boils of all the diseases he could give people? Not only because they're painful, but because they're publicly humiliating, as if to say, everything that you believe in is not only not powerful, but can't stop you from being. This is what happens with Job, by the way, at the book of Job. Job gets boils, and it's a way of saying that every conceivable bad thing that happens to him, he loses his children, he loses his wealth, and then he gets a disease that's not only painful, but is publicly humiliating, okay? So all of that happens, and some of them are allegorical, like I haven't gotten to Zevit's theory yet. This is all preamble. Some of them are allegorical, like darkness, which is not just darkness, but remember the Israelites could see and the Egyptians couldn't, as in And what it says specifically is one man couldn't see the face of the other. In other words, the opposite of what I said about Levinas earlier, right? Levinas building his whole theory on seeing the other, the plague of darkness was that the Egyptians couldn't see the other. But what Zevit talks about in his article is that the plagues are the reversal of creation. And that one after another, if you think about it, right, the heavens and the earth, the waters above and the waters below, the vegetation, the swarms of insects, all of those are mentioned in the creation story. And that what God is doing is showing in a very small scale way, I can create the world, I can uncreate the world. I control all the mechanisms of the universe. Now, you don't want to do what you did in the time of Noah because God promised never to do that again and there's not going to be a wholesale destruction. But to someone who has read the biblical creation story and sees what's going on, the beginning is light and darkness, right? And then there's one child born, an Adam, a firstborn. And all of everything that God is doing to Egypt is saying to the Israelites, just as I made, I can unmake, that ultimate power is mine, right? Which is a beautiful way of understanding what the plagues are really about and seeing that they're not just random, oh, I think I'll hit them with this now and I'll hit them with that now, but that they have a pattern and a meaning. And Zevit goes through all of them and tries to show the pattern, but it's that much more beautiful, I think, and this he doesn't speak about, but it's that much more beautiful if you think about it all as leading towards redemption. You open the door for Elijah, and after all, Elijah is in some way supposed to complete creation by announcing the coming of the Messiah. So remember that I talked before about Franz Rosenzweig's A Star of Redemption, and he says that the three poles of the Jewish tradition are creation, revelation, and redemption. So what Passover does is it shows creation in the plagues, and revelation, because you're leading towards Sinai, right? That's what the Omer is all about. You're walking towards Shavuot, and of course, Elijah presages redemption. So if you don't have an eighth grader, you can use that in your Seder, or if the eighth grader was absent that day, you can use that in the Seder, or if they just weren't paying attention. Or you can say, you know, I read this interesting article online by Professor Zevit, and just amaze them. So anyway, okay. Let's stop there and take questions on either Passover Seder or the section of the Bible that we did. And then starting in what, 2 weeks or 3 weeks?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. We will resume with chapter 31. Yeah.
A simple question. Why did they use the translation manner instead of a place?
Because that's colloquially what it means. And because she said, why did they use the translation manner instead of face? It's colloquially what it means, and also this JPS translation is designed to enable someone to just read the story. And if you came across a phrase in English that said, his face wasn't to me like it was yesterday, you would say, what does that mean? Right? It doesn't work in English unless you are going to really interpret it. And JPS, some people think, went too far. But if you were going to, if somebody says to me, I just want to read the Bible, this is the translation to give them because it is in colloquial English and you can understand. But every time you do that, you're also giving an interpretation, right? To say that what it means is his manner isn't like it was yesterday is not only to translate it, but to interpret it. So, for better or worse. Yeah.
Can you spell the name of Professor Zevit?
Z-E-V, like Victor, I-T. And his first name is Zioni, Z-I-O-N-Y. Zioni Zevit.
One question.
Mm-hmm. Right.
These people who talk to God, like Jacob, or had an encounter with God,
right.
Moses, Jacob, Abraham, did they uncover?
So the question is, to what extent do you uncover the mystery of the universe or God if you have an encounter with God? Let me start at the beginning. When I talk about people being unable to understand the universe, what I mean is this. Let's assume for a minute that your brain is entirely a product of evolution, okay? That in fact there's no God, or if there's a God, God has nothing to do with it. And you started from an amoeba and it gradually evolved, just like your arms evolved and other creatures evolved, and it's an incredibly complex, sophisticated product of evolution, but it's a product of evolution, okay? Now remember, what evolution is designed to do is to help you to survive, right? That's what evolution's great job is. It's not to make you more or less sophisticated, it's to find a niche in nature that's not filled and to enable you to fill it. So to be perfectly evolved is to be able to fill your niche, right? Like cockroaches are perfectly evolved in New York. They fill right niches that no one else wants to fill, and they do it well. If you ever had an apartment in New York, which I did, you know this is true. So if that's true, then you have to, whether it's true or not, actually, you have to realize that our minds have limitations the same way our arms do. Our arms can only reach so far. They can only grasp so much. And the same thing is true with our minds. The difference is, we can see how far our hands go. But you can't see the limitations of your own mind because all you have to see it with is your mind. So all the things that our minds don't understand, we don't understand that we don't understand. Because if we could begin to understand it, then we would be able to comprehend at least that area with our minds. But there's so much, it's like there are probably many, many things in this world that we don't see. In fact, there are. We know that. And we didn't know that we didn't see those things until we got microscopes and telescopes and other things that aided the eye in seeing. So we have artificial aids for the mind, like computers, but even those are designed by minds. And so one of the things that I think is when people talk about a comprehensive theory of everything, yes, as makes sense to our minds, but this, by the way, has a long history in philosophy, the very, very short sort of precis of this is what happened with Hume and Kant. Hume attacked all of science because he said, this is a long answer to a question, but here goes. Hume attacked all of science because he said science is based on the principle that of induction, that if something happens 1,000 times, it will happen 1,001 times. That is, we see the sun rise every single day, so we infer that it will rise tomorrow. He said, but the example he used was, you see one billiard ball touch another, and you see the second billiard ball move, and you infer, that is, you assume that the hitting of the first billiard ball caused the second to move. He said, but what you see is a sequence of events. You don't see cause. Cause is something we assume. It's not something we see. Nobody's ever seen a cause. What you've seen are things that happen one after another, and you assume that they caused, you assume that because I just threw this up, it went up into the air, right? But you don't see the cause, you just see the sequence of actions. So nobody could come up with an answer to that. And Immanuel Kant, who was in his 50s, this ought to give us all hope, before he wrote anything of worth, right? And became the most, probably the greatest philosopher of modern times. Kant read Hume and said he was what he called, he was awakened from his dogmatic slumber, right? In other words, he got very upset at this idea. And what he eventually came up with with very long, elaborate, and very complicated books was that what we see in the world is the product of the structure of our minds. Okay, now you may all nod at this, but people hadn't assumed that before Kant, right? Kant said you can never know things as they are in themselves, right? The thing in itself is always elusive. All you can know is the thing as it presents itself to us, right? And that's the way we interpret the world. And we can guess about the thing in itself, but you can't know it because it's always mediated by our senses, by our touch, by our sight. That's the only way we can know things. So if that's true, and it seems to me clearly true, then what I would say is you can never grasp ultimacy through your mind, which is what all these books that deny God assume. They assume that what you can really know the world through your mind, but that seems to me to be a sort of elementary mistake. However, if you believe that people have other faculties besides those, and that you can know something through encounter that you can't know intellectually, that is, I can't figure you out, but in some way I can know you, or you can know me, then I would say Jacob, no, didn't understand the mystery of God and didn't know the mystery of the universe, but Jacob knew God in a very intimate way, even though ultimately there was lots of God that Jacob could never know because he was a human being. So there's a level on which you can know someone that doesn't have to do with your mind grasping them. And the same thing is true, I think, with God. There's a level on which Jacob could know God, but it had nothing to do with understanding. It had to do with knowing in a biblical way, right? Remember, the biblical know, it also means sexual intercourse. In other words, it means intimate knowing. So that's a different kind of knowing. And that's what I think, that's what, when it says that Moses saw God, panim el panim, there's that word again, face to face, it means that Moses not understood God, but had a more comprehensive relationship to God than anyone who ever lived. So, okay, there you go. That's a long, 1-2, yeah. Yeah, where is Gilead exactly? It has a map in the back that I think you have it in that too. No, you actually only have it. Those of you who have the Eitz Chaim can look at exactly where it is, and let us know. Yeah.
So I'm wondering how Matthew made such a central symbol for Passover, because it seems in the whole story of being released from slavery, there's this one minor detail that
our right. I have a theory about matzah that those of you who get off the pulpit got this theory a while back. Why matzah? So I also think that matzah is, I must say, it's not a great symbol. You know, I mean, it's good in that we've made it good, but normally you would not pick that as the symbol of Passover. Because what is matzah represents the fact that they had to run away from slavery, which is not such a bad thing after all. So big deal. They didn't have, you know, they didn't have croissants as they left Egypt. But which reminded me, just the other day I was telling, there is Fran Lebowitz, who's a humorist in New York, came across a restaurant that opened in her neighborhood. This is years ago, but the restaurant was called Bonjour Croissant. And she said when she saw that, she realized she had to go to France and open a restaurant in Paris called Hello Toast. So she thought it was so ridiculous, you know. And what the best explanation that I've come up with is, I mentioned it here, I think, once before, Mary Moody Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson's aunt, who was so meaningful in his life, said to him once when he was a kid, hurry is for slaves. So the idea that you can't control your own time is what matzah represents. because the inability to have any control over your own time makes you a slave, right? Now, everybody sometimes can't control their time, but a slave never, ever controls his or her time. You can never say, you know, I don't feel like going to work today, or don't wake me up tonight, I'm really tired. So I think that that's what matzah represents, is it's slavery because it's the complete inability to control your own time, which is, by the way, what children feel sometimes too, right? Children feel like, you know, they never get to control their time. They have to do this, they have to do that. And there's some truth to that. What they don't realize is how much that's a fact of life, right? That that's true when you get older too, and that what enslaves you is children. But they don't know that. But it's also true that there is there's an element of inability to control your time that is also part of what the Seder is about, because you take your time in the Seder and you relax and, you know, you're not supposed to be rushed. So that's an ability to control your time. Are you here for an announcement?
Yes.
Go ahead. Okay.
I just want to pass this around again, and if you did not sign in last week, if you could put that in the back, number one. And number two, I just wanted to clarify about our class schedule until the end. We are not here the next 2 weeks because of Pesach. Then we are here the 23rd of April. The 30th is canceled.
Oh.
Okay? And then we have two classes in May, May 7th and May 14th. Originally on the schedule, you said May 21st. That's also canceled.
May 7th and May 14th.
I will email it to you, but I want to let you know. The next 2 weeks are canceled. And we are here April 23rd. Okay? And we're not here the 30th. And then we are here May 7th and May 14th. So the first two Thursdays of May. Okay?
And that's the last
one. Yes. For this season. Right, we have three more classes after this, basically. Okay. Okay, so, yes. Go ahead.
You said that Galit Dayan, she might come and talk about geology, and they found some facts that this happened. How does this change your mind about
it doesn't change my mind at all.
Can you repeat the
question? The question was, well, first of all, not that they found facts that this happened. I get at least once every couple weeks someone who's done new research or someone who's, all the stuff that reflects the possibility of Israelite presence in Egypt. This is all old stuff and has been. I mean, Hofmeyr, if you want to read the most learned scholar who makes the case for Israel's presence in Egypt is Hofmeyr. But I always thought, and if you listen to the classes that I gave right after the sermon, I always thought it was plausible and likely that there was a small group of Israelites in Egypt. That's not the issue, right? The issue was, did the Exodus happen the way the Bible talks about? And there, the evidence is less what happened in Egypt than what happened in Canaan. Because now, you see, what makes all of this an issue now is that for the first time, we can do archaeology in the land of Israel. We couldn't do this till the 20th century. And archaeology in the land of Israel, if there were an influx of 600,000, which actually ends up to be 2 million, if there were an influx of 2 million people at that time, we would know. But there isn't. That's the issue. The issue is not that we have not found anything in the Sinai Desert, which is true, even though we found, by the way, artifacts from people who predate the Israelites. But we haven't found anything from the Israelites. Okay, there are lots of ways of explaining that. And it's not that there is Israelite influence in Egypt, because don't forget, Egypt controlled Canaan for most of these years. So it wouldn't be at all surprising if there was a back and forth. And if once the Israelites were constituted, there were Israelites in Egypt and otherwise. And it wouldn't be at all surprising even if there were Israelites in Egypt that left Egypt and joined up with people in Canaan, which is what most modern scholars assume. In fact, if you have the Eitz Chaim, and you read Lee Levine's essay in the back of the Eitz Chaim, which is about the Exodus, you will see that he says exactly what I said, right? Which is that's what most scholars assume about the Exodus, that we are an amalgam. We're a mix, most likely, Jews, of people who were in Egypt and people who were in Canaan. The Bible even gives you some sort of indication of this by talking about an Erev Rav, that is, people who were mixed in with the Jews who left Egypt. But the real bone of contention these days is less what exists in Egypt than what exists in Israel, than why there is no evidence of a sudden change in all the things that you would expect a sudden change in if the Israelites had come there. There's no change in styles of pottery, which is the major mean. There's no change in styles of homes. There's no great increase in settlements. All those things that would have happened if you'd had a couple million people come. Does that mean that Israelites weren't enslaved in Egypt and left? No, I suspect they probably were. It just means that there wasn't this giant people that crossed in mass waves through the desert and then settled in the land of Canaan. But we'll see what Galit Dayan has to say about it. And as I say, the stuff that you get in DVDs and in articles, you have to run those through people who spend their lives studying it, and it's a fascinating field. But the guy who makes the best case, it's called Israel in Egypt, I think, is Hofmeyer. But like genuine scholarly work, it's not a breezy read, right? It takes a little work to get through his book, but it's a very interesting one, and this is ongoing, and it's a good thing. It's a good debate to have. Yes.
Back to Jacob, is this dream here to justify what he did with the? I mean, or is it the
it's
reason
a good
he
question.
Did that is because he had this dream, but the dream is mentioned after?
I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not sure that anyone can. I think that it's at least plausible that he had the dream first, which is why he did all this, and then he told his wives about it, right? Because it makes sense that he would. I mean, where did he get the idea of the streaked and speckled and spotted? Who knows? Maybe it came to him in a dream. A lot of creative ideas do. Then he did it, and it worked. And then he decided that it came from God because it was from a dream. Well, I don't know if it was honest or not. That's hard to say if it was honest. He got Lavan's agreement, and then he sort of tricked him, but it was certainly within the letter of the law, because he did get Lavan's agreement that he could take all the streaked and speckled, right? So, okay, we have one more announcement. Do we have another announcement? Yes, another announcement, okay.
I just wanted to come by and thank everybody for your support for my team and training, Leukemia Lymphoma Society. I know many of you made donations after my husband made a pitch, and I just wanted to tell you that it means so much to both of us. And it really helps me to get to the finish line, so thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah. So to date, I have raised $75,000. Wow. I'm still working.
We're trying to get to 100, so if you haven't made a donation yet, you can the web. How do you get the website most easily? If you yes.
The best way is actually
can
to stop by Rebecca.
The website again.
Excuse me.
The website.
Right. You know what? The best way for me to send it to you is to stop by my husband's office and give your email address to his assistant Rebecca.
Or send me an email and I'll send you back.
Yes.
Just can send me an email.
You have all our emails. Can you just forward the information?
Sure. Okay. Dahlia does. Dahlia does. Sure. I'll have her forward the information to you. I'll tell Dahlia to send it out. And also to put you on off the pulpit. And you can always, if you get off the pulpit and you don't want it, write back and say, take me off. And you can be taken off. Okay. What's that? Lunch and learn. No, lunch and learn, because it's the day before Pesach, so they don't have it.
Right.
Oh, there's Dahlia still here. Oh, okay. So Dahlia, will you do both? Will you make sure everyone is on off the pulpit and send out the link? If you don't have the link, I'll send it to you. Okay. No, we're gonna set up an evening with Galit Dayan, and I will be there to talk about the Exodus. And she who got her PhD. This is the wife of the consul general. She got her PhD in Egyptology, and she's convinced that there is solid evidence that there were Israelites in Egypt. So I think it would be a fascinating evening. She's also wonderful, wonderful person. Don't know yet. We'll let you know. I'll let you know. We haven't set it up, but yes.
Just one observation from last week. Everybody started talking about how with Jacob and Rebecca and all that they're doing and how kind of they're embarrassed about it or
right.
Things of that sort. It kind of, I take issue with that because we're looking at this through eyes of years and years after.
Right.
much that that has happened. So, you know, people are more educated, more, and you're looking at it from these eyes. I take issue with that. I mean, it's like these people were, you know, back then.
Well, absolutely.
To put them to so
here's what I would say yes and no. In the sense that I completely agree with you on from one point of view. I just, in today's Jewish Journal, I have an article on Yehuda Halevi, who wrote the Kuzari, okay? He's one of the great figures of Jewish history. And he gets attacked sometimes because he thought only Jews had souls capable of prophecy. So what I say in the article is, if someone today says that Jews have a different kind of soul from other people, then that's a kind of metaphysical racism, if you say it today. But to say it in 1490 or 1480, when actually he was earlier, but a little bit earlier, when Halevi said it in Spain, when, you know, Jews shortly are going to get kicked out of Spain, that makes perfect sense. And if we judge him by this standard, we diminish ourselves, but we don't diminish him. Also, as Rabbi Korobkin, who wrote the new translation, points out, he says, since there's no prophecy today, what Yehuda Halevi says doesn't even have any force. However, with biblical characters, even though I agree with you about their behavior in one sense, remember that the Jewish tradition assumes that their behavior is always relevant to us. So there's a part of Judaism that judges them as better than us because this is Jacob. So if you look at it historically, you say, okay, he may be better than us, but he doesn't understand what we understood. But in a traditional reading, he understands what we understood plus. So it depends how you...
And then also you can learn from them.
Right. Yeah, you can certainly do. You can certainly do. But it's very rare, especially as I want to say, if you went to a very traditional Torah class, they would not take the approach of you can learn from Jacob's mistakes, right? Rather, you can learn how to correct your own mistakes from Jacob. So, yeah.
So assuming, back to Pesach, assuming that Exodus through Egypt, as it's described, didn't occur as we
right.
read about it, at which point in our history did we come up with that story?
Depends who you ask. I mean, there's a lot of speculation. It depends who and when you think the Torah was written. So the general scholarly consensus, not so much including the book of Deuteronomy, is that the Torah was finally put together of previous existing strands around the time that the northern kingdom was destroyed, that is in 722, when all those people fled south, and then in Judah brought their traditions with them, and those traditions were interwoven. In other words, we're talking about some 600 years after the Exodus, and beyond that. But people, see, here's, if you take a modern, and we did this for over several classes at the beginning of the Torah class, and I don't want to go over it all now, maybe we'll do it again next year if people want. But the general assumption of modern scholars about the Torah is that the creation of the Torah was not an event, it was a process. That is, over time, it's not that somebody sat down one day and had all these stories in front of them and wrote them all down. It's that there were sacred traditions of the Jewish people that got told and retold and shaped. And, you know, writing was a later development. All these traditions existed orally for a long time and then eventually got written down and then got transmitted and sort of assumed the final shape, although nobody knows when they assumed the final shape, because the earliest manuscripts of the Torah we have, right, full manuscripts, are from the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are 1,300 years after the Exodus. So that's a long time. So we don't know when the earliest full written manuscripts are. But this, by the way, this is part of Yehuda Halevi's argument. He says it's clear that the Jewish tradition is true because 600,000 people wouldn't lie. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Why is it that God kept sending prophets until 2,000 years ago? So many prophets, and then all of a sudden, you give the Torah, and then there's no more prophets.
Because.
Did you figure it out for yourself?
No, but, well, yes and no. Advice then is through interpretation of the tradition. That is, you said, it was very interesting what you said. You said you give advice until they die, but actually you give advice until you die,
right?
And then, well, the reason I say that is because, and then what they have to do is live off the wisdom that you have left them. And that's part of growing up. So what God said is, I've left you this vast legacy of wisdom. Now I leave you sages in the place of prophets, and sages are supposed to interpret and understand. Sages really are, in the Jewish tradition, supposed to take the place of prophets. And that at a certain point, prophecy ceased because God has told us the essential messages, and then we have to do what children have to do, which is understand and live off the legacy that they've been given. So.
The next question is, are we wiser enough to be able to use all of that, or are we not worthy to connect to us?
There are both trajectories in the Jewish tradition. That is, in one way, Moses is at the top trajectory, and then it goes down and down and down and down and down. But the truth is that that you also have, the phrase on standing on the shoulders of giants? You can see farther because you're standing on the shoulders of giants. There was actually a sociologist named Robert Merton who wrote a whole book, it's referred to as Atzag, On the Shoulders of Giants, in which he traces the history of that one phrase, right? Goes all the way back to like the 12th or 13th century. Started off as a letter and became a book. It's an amazingly entertaining book for just that. He finds it in all sorts of out-of-the-way places, including in a Jewish sage in the 13th century. So Maimonides was a much, much, much smarter man than any man you are likely to meet. But one thing Maimonides didn't know was the writings of Maimonides. So the truth is, you have the opportunity to stand on top of Maimonides, so to speak, even though nobody is Maimonides. So it goes both ways. The tradition says that you're closer to revelation if you're closer to Sinai, but on the other hand, you have the advantage of all that accumulated wisdom. So, yeah, 1-2.
The plagues can be incredibly frightening to young children.
Yes.
And you can't exactly say, well, this is the reverse of creation.
Nope.
And so how can you explain, to make it less frightening? Especially the last plague, killing all the unborn sons and everything. It just is,
right.
The firstborn sons, rather.
Yeah. I'm not sure that there's a way of explaining this other than, I have not found, it's funny, of all the things that seem to be frightening to kids, I've never found a kid particularly frightened by the plagues, not unless you're too vivid about them. But not if you just sort of read through them, it has a sort of fairy tale quality.
Yeah.
When the kid is old enough to be frightened by them, then they're old enough to be engaged in a discussion about them. But then they're old enough to have a real discussion about it and to try to figure out why such a thing would happen. That actually is an interesting and worthwhile discussion. And part of what you would have to figure out with them is what they think is God's prerogative and what isn't. Does God give all life, and does God therefore have the right to take all life? But I don't know of a way. David Hartman, who is an Orthodox rabbi in Israel, says that the first thing we do with our children is haunt them with historical memories. That's his phrase, a beautiful phrase. And that's exactly what Jews do, especially with the Pesach Seder. And yes, things are terribly frightening. But I would say you can't teach a child history. You can't teach them religion. You can't teach them anything if you're not willing to teach them the terrible viciousness that, pockmarks all of human history. So, yeah. Last two. 1-2.
Buber read Maimonides. Maimonides did not read Buber.
I think that's a safe statement.
What goes on in the process of our educated
right.
mind is influenced by those who come before us.
Right.
Bach.
Right.
Bartok heard Bach.
All the bees.
Never heard Bartok.
Right.
And we bring to that our process and our culture and our super ego, if I can use that phrase, our cop. Mm-hmm. Decide what we're willing to listen to, what we're
yes.
willing to read. That makes it a little bit, you need a little help as you go through this.
Yeah.
It's hard to do it alone.
Right. Well, also, all of us are tremendously influenced by the tidal wave of the culture that we're in, which is just inevitable. So, yeah.
I'm wondering if you'd like to recommend a book about
the lives of
the prophets.
Sure, I mean, the most eloquent book is Heschel's, right? Heschel's The Prophets. Let's see, where else would, other than Heschel, you know, I know of a couple of books. I just read a book by a guy named Rubinstein on Isaiah and Jeremiah that was pretty good. But other than Heschel, I don't know who writes about, oh, well, if you want a political take on the prophets, but also has a lot of good information about the prophets, you can read Norman Podhoretz recently, about 2 or 3 years ago, wrote a book on the prophets. But realize that he gets the prophets to speak like a neoconservative, right? That's his, honest to God, that's his agenda. But having said that, okay, having said that, he also has a lot of good, interesting information on the prophets, and you just, there's nothing wrong with reading somebody's take on something as long as you know what their take is, right? And you can agree with it or disagree with it. But one of the scourges, and I will close with this, one of the really terrible things about the internet age is it allows people to select their information too carefully. That's why I never boycott a newspaper. And I think boycotts of newspapers are counterproductive and foolish, especially in this age when newspapers are dying. You don't boycott a newspaper because it's good for you to read information that you disagree with. It's not bad for you. You shouldn't only have a newspaper that says what you think newspapers should say, right? The whole point of reading a newspaper is to see other points of view and to hear things that you don't know. But if you go on the internet, every time you see a headline or a newspaper, whatever, that you don't like, you don't click on that, and you just reinforce your own views. And that's not learning. That's just reinforcement. Okay, thanks.